Holy Gospel according to John, the 18th and 19th chapters. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," they objected. This took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "Your own people and chief priests have handed you over to me. What is it you have done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" Pilate retorted. With this, he went out again to the Jews gathered there and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him. But it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they slapped him in the face. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I am bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify! Crucify!" But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid and went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus. But Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize I have the power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of the greater sin." From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jewish leaders kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate had him handed over to be crucified. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
Please be seated and let us pray. And now, O God, may the words which I speak, the thoughts that we think together, and the actions that we would take as a result Be acceptable and pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. What is truth? I think it's hard to imagine a more relevant or profound question. How we define truth, where we seek truth, how we align our lives with truth has momentous consequence, ultimately shaping the course of our lives, the quality of our relationships, even our eternal destiny. It's interesting that in John's Gospel, John uses the root word for truth 48 times. He clearly has an interest in presenting to us the truth. And throughout this Lenten sermon series called Conversations with Jesus, we've overheard people speaking with Jesus, five men, five women, speaking with the one who is himself, the truth embodied in human flesh. This Thursday, we'll hear the final monologue of one who had a significant conversation with Jesus. It's Judas, the disciple who betrayed him. And we'll hear, as we did this morning, two gospel accounts. We'll hear this Thursday, Mark and John's accounts. And next Sunday, we'll celebrate the resurrection of our Lord, and we'll conclude the series by asking, what will you say to this man? Today, we overhear Jesus' conversation with Pontius Pilate, who infamously asked, what is truth? Before we listen in, let me tell you what we know about the man. When he meets Jesus, Pilate is a very long way from home. Some traditions even tell us he was born in Scotland, although we have no way of really being able to check that out. We know he was a career politician or perhaps a soldier who had risen to the level of being a provincial governor, although a governor of a very inconsequential backwater province of the Roman Empire, a land called Judea, a place populated by a people fiercely devoted to their monotheistic religion and equally vehemently opposed to their Roman occupiers. And Pilate had probably hoped that an effective tour of duty in Judea would bring better things, senior postings, better pay, more rank, and if possible, less recalcitrant subjects. He had been appointed governor of Judea by Tiberius Caesar in the year AD 26, and he held that position for 10 years until AD 36. The primary task of a Roman governor was to extract as much as he possibly could from his subjects, usually via taxation, while also ensuring that the Pax Romana, that is the Roman peace and Roman authority, held within his territory. And because of the fierce religious and nationalistic commitments of the people he ruled, Pilate had a very difficult job indeed. If he is too lenient, he invites further resistance and rebellion. If he's too ruthless, he incites animosity and great rebellion and perhaps even insurrection. Now, of course, the aphorism, it's not what you know, but who you know that counts. That applied just as much to Pilate's life and career and time as it does to our own. Pilate was no exception. He owed his appointment to a man named Lucius Aelius Sejanus, the commander of the Praetorian Guard in Rome. But Sejanus died on October 18th. 31 AD. And as I said last week, the events of Holy Week likely took place, this first Holy Week, in late March and early April of 33 AD. And that means that Pilate had lost his major supporter with the Roman Empire about 17 months prior to this conversation with Jesus. That meant if there were trouble in Judea, Pilate would have no one in Rome to argue his side of the case. He would not be given the benefit of the doubt. And so when Pilate meets Jesus, his margin for error is narrow indeed. He must choose his path carefully. And that was counter to his nature from everything we know about him. He could be ruthless, brash, insensitive, and needlessly provocative. Throughout the previous 7 years of his gubernatorial tenure, On several occasions, he had incited the resentment, ire, annoyance, displeasure, indignation, and outright exasperation of the people of Judea. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that during the first year of his administration, he had army standards with the image of the Roman emperors brought into Jerusalem. And certainly he was poking his subjects in the eye, but remember, there's more to it than that. That action was exceedingly odious to his Jewish subjects because Caesar was revered as a god throughout the empire, and to have those images was a direct violation of the commandment not to worship any graven images, not even to make them. Pilate had those standards secretly erected under cover of darkness, and when the people saw them the next morning, riots and protests broke out, and Pilate gave orders to his troops to draw their swords, but when he saw the Jews' willingness to die for their faith, he backed off. On another occasion, Pilate, prior to Jesus' crucifixion, Pilate had similarly offensive golden shields displayed at Herod's palace. This time he also relented and had them removed because he didn't want word of his corruptions getting back to Rome. And on yet another occasion, demonstrations broke out against him when he sought to use money from the temple treasury to build an aqueduct to bring water into the city. This time, Pilate sent his soldiers in civilian clothes amongst the crowds. And then when the protesters started to raise a riot, he had his soldiers draw their swords and attack the people, causing great bloodshed. Luke's gospel even tells us of an occasion in which some people told Jesus about Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. Clearly, Pilate was ruthless, violent, and a victim of his own incompetence. And in fact, just 3 years later, because of the way he handled a Samaritan uprising so ruthlessly and brutally, he was removed from his office, called back to Rome, sent into exile, and he disappears from history in AD 37. So by the time he stands with Jesus on this early morning of April 3rd, AD 33, the Roman governor is in a precarious position indeed. He has no desire to intervene into what can clearly be seen from his perspective as an internal Jewish squabble pertinent only to their strange religion. His desire to appease his subject is evidenced by his meeting Jesus' accusers outside of his residence. For the Jews to enter into the dwelling of a Gentile would be a horrible thing at that time because it would make them ceremonially unclean and unavailable to celebrate the Passover. And John is keen to point out the irony of that moment for us. Jesus' opponents scrupulously avoid ceremonial uncleanness while not being one whit concerned about burdening themselves with the moral guilt of condemning an innocent man. Pilate, of course, immediately recognizes that Jesus poses no real threat. But if he doesn't placate his subjects, he knows the Jewish authorities will incite the crowds to riot. He would have to once again use force to restore the peace, shedding Jewish blood during the great festival of the Jews. And word of that violence would inevitably get back to Rome. His handling of the situation would come into question. His reputation would suffer, and quite possibly he would lose his position. The gospel accounts, therefore, record for us how Pilate labors to extricate himself from this difficult conundrum. First, he seeks to refuse to take up Jesus' case at all. He tells the authorities, take him yourself, judge him by your own laws. But Jesus' accusers are out for blood, so Luke's gospel tells us they frame the accusation in political rather than religious terms, mixing falsehood with truth, stating, we have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah king. When Pilate learns that Jesus is a Galilean, we know this from other texts than the ones we read this morning, but he sends Jesus to the ruler of that territory, to Herod Antipas. And conveniently, Herod, like Pilate, is in Jerusalem seeking to maintain civil order during the Passover. And Herod does nothing except ridicule and mock Jesus and send him back to Pilate. Matthew and Mark tells us that Pilate knew it was because of envy that the Jewish authorities had handed over Jesus. So in other words, Pilate calculates. He reasons, well, Jesus is popular with the crowds. The authorities are jealous, and for that reason they've raised these trumped-up baseless charges against him. So if I offer to release a prisoner to the crowd, certainly they will clamor for Jesus, who's popular with them. But Pilate miscalculates. Mobs are notoriously fickle things. The crowd calls out for the release of the insurrectionist Barabbas. That puts Pilate in a bind. He has no choice but to release Barabbas. And that's the second great irony of our text, that a man guilty for the crime of which Jesus falsely stands is accused, is released. And Pilate tries one more desperate move in order to mollify the crowd. He has Jesus flogged. But nothing less than crucifixion will appease this bloodthirsty crowd. And finally, after Jesus' innocence has been pronounced by Pilate, not once, not twice, but three times, Pilate senses his perilous position, and he caves in to political pressure and orders Jesus to be crucified. As we read the gospel accounts, we clearly see the root of Pilate's political miscalculation is not merely that he succumbed to the crowd. No, it's something greater than that. As he desperately sought to balance the politics of his Roman superiors against the religious and nationalistic fervor of his subjects, Pilate failed to account for something I like to call the politics of Jesus. When Pilate asks, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Jesus is fully aware that that phrase could be defined in two different ways. In other words, if Pilate is asking from his own Roman interests, if he's saying something like, "Jesus, do you have zealot-like designs against Caesar, hoping to establish an alternative political kingdom?" then Jesus' answer, of course, is negative. But if he's asking from a Jewish perspective, "Are you the promised Messiah?" then Jesus would respond positively. Jesus can't answer Pilate's question until he sort of teases that out from Pilate himself, and that's why he asks the question, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it about me?" Pilate, of course, responds. He says, "Am I a Jew?" And that shows his disdain for his subjects, and it also reveals that it was the Jewish leaders who had presented Jesus to Pilate as both a messianic pretender and a political threat to Rome. And then Jesus answers Pilate's question, stating that he is indeed a king, but that his kingdom is not of this world. By that, Jesus is denying that his kingdom has a this-worldly origin or quality. But he's not denying that it has a this-worldly destination. That is, his kingdom does not come from this world, but it is for this world. And that important distinction seems to be lost on Pilate. His dim grasp of the situation before him is evidenced in his exclamation, "You are a king then." And then that is when we finally reach what I think is the singularly most important words Jesus speaks in his conversation. He says, "You say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." Jesus is saying, "I have come into the world to proclaim one great truth. That I am the God King who will rule over all the world for all eternity." And if that were not momentous enough, Jesus adds the clincher, "Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." Jesus turns the tables. And now Pilate is on trial as Jesus directly challenges him with the stark choice that lie before Pilate on that Friday morning. Jesus is saying, "Pilate, I am the king. It would behoove you to get on the right side of the truth." And we know all that happens next. Weary of being caught between Rome and Judea, weary from 7 years of picking his way through the minefield of his subjects' claims to a monopoly on divine truth, Pilate seeks to cut the conversation short, and dismissively and derisively he huffs, "What is truth?" And of course, as readers, we see the third great irony of the scene. Jesus, the one who is the embodiment of truth, The one who is the way, the truth, and the life is standing right there within arm's reach of Pilate. Here literally is a man who would not recognize the truth if it stood right before him. And that's not just irony. That's a tragedy. It's a tragedy with which we are all too familiar, as we in our time have more access to the truth than any people ever in the history of humanity. Proverbs 23:23 says, "Buy the truth and sell it not." We buy the truth as we invest ourselves, as we invest our time, as we invest our lives to meeting the one who is the truth revealed in this book. Pilate's conversation with Jesus has its background, all that political intrigue and all of his history of his own political career. And John presents that all with great irony. But it's really a catastrophe. Pilate seeks to find a middle course between Jesus and his opponents, between truth and falsehood. But Pilate is a study in the impossibility of compromise, in the inevitability of decision. And he seems to glimpse the truth of Jesus, but realizes the cost is too high to follow him. So he seeks a compromise, and it all fails. His life asks for us the question, what is it in your life? What is it in my life that's trying to draw a compromise with Jesus? Even a neutral stance is a decision against Jesus. In the end, Pilate doesn't have the strength to stand with Jesus, and the truth is, neither do we. But if we seek from God the strength to do so, he will abundantly and graciously and freely provide it. The more we daily receive that strength, the more we align ourselves with Jesus, the more practiced we become at living in accordance with the truth. Because truth is not something that we get out of a test tube or a mathematical formula. We don't have the truth in our pockets or on our smartphones. It's a gift. A gift with a strange quality that, like Jesus' kingdom, comes from elsewhere, but is meant to take up residence in this world. Jesus has come to give us this truth because he himself is the truth. Truth is a person. May you and I, by our words, by our actions, give a clear, distinct, and irrefutable answer to that question Pilate asked, what is truth? Truth is a person. And his name is Jesus.